Well, greetings, everyone. This is the Limark TechNet, and I am AC2GS. And Dick will be away this session doing something else, and it'll be me and Paul. One of us is going to be playing the part. You've heard that Dick has mentioned that he's put more hours into the TechNet than Johnny Carson did on the Johnny Carson show. So one of us will be Joan Rivers, and the other will be Ed McMahon for tonight. So let me ask Paul if he's there by the microphone. Are you there, Paul?
AC2GSWS2N. Good evening, Roy. Drop it. And I made it tonight, so very good. You will hold the fort down. I don't know how we're going to do with the technical questions. I guess that could be tried, but I'll be here for the space program and any other science questions that you come up with. Roy, if you want to take the lead, that's fine with me. I'll copy call letters down and help you out the best I can. How's that? Back to you.
Okay, that'll do fine, Paul. For those who are not quite familiar with me, in addition to being the science guy on the Limark TechNet, I am also the TechNet guy on the Kings County Radio Club TechNet. So we have a technical question and answer session on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month there at the other repeater. So I guess we'll kind of try and wing it. I don't have the experience that Dick has had, but I'll see what I can do. And in a pinch, we can call on the other participants of the technical net to add their experience and their wisdom. So I will open this session of the technical net to anyone interested. Please give me your call sign and your first name, and I will put you on the list for tonight.
This is Rich. And who are you, Doc?
Very good, Rich. You're number one on the list. Anyone else want to give me their call sign and their name, put them on the list for questions for tonight, or comments or statements, what have you?
And just as a note, I don't hear the Sheldon machine so far, so that might not be operating. But, you know, I'll keep it on in the background. Roy.
Hey, very good, Paul. I have Echo Link up, and there are three people on that. I have the chat room up. I'm by myself there. So I think some people just assumed that we weren't going to have anything tonight. But we'll. Anyone else want to give me their call sign and their name and put themselves on the list for questions for tonight?
PM, ready.
AC2LA.
Okay, Dan, you're on the list. Anyone else want to put themselves on the list for tonight for any kind of questions? We take technical questions. We take scientific questions. Hell, we'll take any field of science that that you're curious about, and we'll try our best tonight.
Enter exchange on the big run.
Okay, Wesley, do you have a question tonight, or you just want to tell me that you're there in the background?
Well, I'm on the background. I was thinking about the new form of the lightning discharge, comparing to the old one, the radioactive one that were removed in the 60s. How could you make the new one that would also be working as an ionizing one, but that was just a concern. Thank you.
Okay, we'll put you on the list. Anyone else on the list?
W2US.
And your name is Russ? Okay, one more time, I'll call out for any call signs, for any questions, comments, statements, and if nothing, then we'll go to the top of the list. But anyone else want to put their name on the list?
Whiskey 2, India Uniform Sierra. I'm in New Jersey, just read the mail.
Can you give me your call sign one more time?
Whiskey Alpha 2, India Uniform Sierra. Copy.
And your first name is Steven?
Yes, call. Thank you.
Okay, very good, Stephen. You're on the list. Anyone else who wants to put their name on the list for any questions or comments or statements for the technical net tonight?
To DUE.
Your suffix, I did not get your prefix. Could you give me your prefix one more time?
Sure. It's November 2, Delta Uniform Echo. My name is Ted, just checking in. No questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Ted. One more time, I'll give a call out. If anyone has any questions or comments that they want to make tonight on the technical net, please give me your call sign and your first name, and then we'll start going down the list.
Hey.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're breaking up. If you can kind of raise the gain or adjust the drive level, and give it another try. Okay, I got KC2. What about the suffix? No, you're falling out of the repeater. You know, check your adjustments and see if maybe you can gain a little bit more power or adjust the antenna if it's movable. And we'll get back to you because I'm sure we're going to have some spare time later on anyway, and I'll ask for a late check-in. So let me start with the list. Rich N2EO, what's your question for tonight, Rich?
Okay, good evening. And I got two. One is very short. The first question, I have three clocks. The MFJ clocks, they use a battery backup, and they use, each clock uses four solar panels. This new one that I bought is an updated model. The solar cells in the light don't seem to be charging a chargeable battery, an internal battery. Soon as the sun goes down, the clocks go blank. Now, the other two clocks, which are older, had a similar problem. When me and Patty moved here from Whitestone, Queens, the clocks were not put up right away, and we had a reset. After we moved here, they were in a box for many months because I was recuperating from surgery. When we opened up the box and got them out, they functioned also in a similar manner. The solar cells, when the sun went down, nothing. It took about a month, and they came back to life, and they're still working. This clock is brand new. I'm wondering what you think. Would it be a bad rechargeable battery, not taking a charge? Or possibly you think the solar cells are not giving off enough power. It'll take a while. MFJ has what they call a 1-year money back guarantee. So no need to return them right now. Wait, and to you.
Well, you know, it's kind of difficult to diagnose over a radio, but the way that things usually work, the weakest link of a solar battery and a rechargeable battery hooked into each other is that the rechargeable battery is probably not fresh, it's not new, it's been probably sitting on a shelf for X number of months or years, and so it's fully discharged itself. Now, sometimes by going through repetitive charge, recharge cycles, you can bring it back to some degree of health. It's vaguely reminiscent of your problem with your lead acid cells, where you let it run too low and caused significant problems with the lead acid cells. Most rechargeable batteries don't tolerate full discharge very well, and they cause problems. Now, some of them you can kind of breathe life back into, as I said before, by repeatedly charging them, which is what you did with your old devices. This might just be a dead rechargeable battery. I would probably, and they probably have a box full of these things. They may not be terribly fresh either. But I would look first in the rechargeable battery itself. It's the most likely thing to be faulty. If the solar battery wasn't working, you know, then you wouldn't get any power. So it works to a degree, and it's kind of difficult for a solar battery to kind of work at 10% power. You know, it really has to have something terribly wrong with it. But rechargeable batteries are infamous for not being able to hold their charge if they're too old or they've been discharged for too long.
Okay, boy. Maybe you're right. I'm going to give it a little try, a little chance. Because if I put it in the sunlight, it does come back, but the battery only holds for a few hours after sunset. I like these clocks, because especially this one, the digits are very large, and I have cataracts, so, and I got it right over the on the wall, where I could see it plainly in the ham shack. This one, unlike the other two, not only gives time, it gives day, date, and indoor temperature. So it was only $15, but I do want to get it working right.
Well, as I suggested, you could try just repeatedly recycling him and hoping that you can breathe life back into them. Failing that, you can contact MSJ and they'll probably just send you another battery in the mail. I don't know exactly how this particular unit is designed, whether it's user-friendly as far as swapping out the rechargeable batteries. Some are easier than others. Personally, I tend to prefer battery-driven devices. With liquid crystal displays, the amount of power output is very, very small. A lot of my clocks have C-cell batteries in the back of them, or some of them even have double A's, and they last for a whole year. And to me, it's a lot less trouble than trying to remember to light up the room that they're in to recharge them. But, you know, whatever works for you, and I understand that you like the aesthetics of the MSJ. I have a very nice clock here at the shack from a place called Dispatch Dual Time that has a very nice 24-hour, 12-hour analog display that took me a while to find, but I really like it.
Okay, boy. Well, thank you. I can say they have a one-year guarantee, what they call a no-matter-what guarantee. So I'll give it a little while. I did not buy it directly from MFJ. I bought it from R&L Electronics because they're one of the few companies that had them in stock. Anyway, the other question. You're a medical doctor, but what makes you so smart on other subjects?
I eat my vegetables. No, but really, I'm just curious. I'm curious about a lot of things, and we live in a great information age where there's the internet and there's Google, and in addition to that, I love to read and have lots and lots of books, And I've actually just been in this hobby for 6.5 years, but I bought just about every other book that the ARRL publishes and a bunch of other books, too. And I read them, and there's all kinds of useful facts in them. That's all.
Okay, boy. I don't want to tie it up, but the KCRA, I'll get in there and get on that net. I love it. Is that, which is the input, which is the output? Because I know it's a one-make split.
Okay, first things first, I'm not with the Kings County Repeater Association. That's what the KCRA is. I'm with the organization called the Kings County Radio Club, which is a different organization, which is also based in Kings County and leads to way too much confusion, unfortunately. KC2RC, which is the Kings County Radio Club's repeater, is 146.730 with a negative 600 offset and a PL tone of 88.5. And as I said, I do a little technical net on the second and fourth Tuesdays, Wednesdays rather, of the month. So, and you're always welcome. Anyone else is welcome as well. And I also write little articles in the e-log. If you read the newsletter, if you thumb through it, eventually you will find one of my works.
You're in to Lindy with a comment about those clocks.
Very good, Barry. Tell us what you think of the clocks.
You don't want to know that. No, I'm just joking. I think Richie should put them in bright sunlight all day. In other words, not in the room, right in the window looking at bright sunlight. That might fix those batteries.
And WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I was thinking what Barry was thinking, but, you know, the daytime at this time of year is the shortest time of the year, for, you know, for the daylight. So I wouldn't be surprised if those things work a little bit better when the summertime shows up. I have these lights, rechargeable lights, that you stick in the grass. I attach a couple of fences, and in the summertime, they'll come on and they'll stay lit probably, you know, 7, 8 hours almost through the whole night. But in the wintertime, you're lucky if they stay lit for about an hour after dark. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, well, ultimately it depends upon the capacity of the solar batteries, how much efficiency they are, and the efficiency of the circuit. LCD-driven clocks run with, you know, a milliwatt, 2 milliwatts, you know, not that much power. But I do agree with Barry that solar batteries work better outside than inside. They catch a lot more of the spectrum than you'll have inside your house. There's glass that blocks the ultraviolet. There's glass that blocks other frequencies, your incandescent light, or you might have a cold fluorescent bulb, or you might have an LED. So if you can get it out to the bright sunlight on a relatively cloudless day, that would probably improve your chances of reforming the charging in the battery. So I would agree with that as another option for you. So any other questions, comments, statements about Richard's problem with his MFJ clock? By the way, I think our Echo Link is down right now.
The Echo Link is down. I tried it. It's not working.
I think it came right back up. Let me click in and see if there's anything going on inside there.
No, I'm trying to straighten it out. It's not picking up any audio.
Someone complained on the EchoLink text that he couldn't hear any audio, and then he just bailed. And, okay, so you rebooted, Eric. Very good. Rich, that's it for the question tonight?
Yes, it is, boy. I don't want to drag it out. You got a long list in there, but all right. I've been putting it in the window. I was told by MFJ it takes an incandescent bulb, don't use the fluorescent or LEDs, and that's what we have here. We don't have any more incandescents. I guess I'll have to put it outside. Barry, I'd like to give you a phone call. Go on to the next person, boy. And to you.
Okay, very good, Rich. I just want to add for the audience that some solar batteries are very frequency picky. They receive and transform the energy of a very, very short bandwidth of visible light, and they don't really work well with other frequencies. In the old days, incandescent lights were basically just a black body heat source, and it lit up across the entire spectrum. Nowadays, we play fancy with single frequency emitters, light emitting diodes, light up red, green, and blue, and we see it as white, but it's really red, green, and blue, and cold fluorescents equally have phosphor dyes that add up to white color in our recognition, but is not a perfect spectrum. If you take a prism out to the sun, you see this beautiful red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, green. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. The trouble is that indoors, if you do that with anything but an incandescent bulb, you're going to see these weird little bands of very pure different colors like red, green, and blue. But that's our brave new world. So let me move on to Dan, AC2LA. What's your question for tonight, Dan?
Hey, good evening. How you doing? My question is about, I have a Signalink USB, the external sound card. And I'm using with a Kenwood TS2000 and a Dell computer. It's not a laptop, it's a desktop. And when I plug the signal link into my TS2000, it makes about an S5 noise on the HF bands. So it's really not usable. It's only when there's a complete path from the computer to the radio. So it's USB on the computer to USB on the external sound card, the SignalLink USB. And then there's a RJ45 that goes to a DIM plug on the back of the 2000. If the USB comes out of the computer, it doesn't make any interference at all. So there's nothing going on with the SignalLink itself. But I guess there's noise coming from the computer that the SignalLink puts into the rig. So I thought I would put some toroids on it, and I have a pretty big toroid on the back of both of those cables right near the signal link. And it's on receive, and it's on transmit too, but it's on receive without transmitting at all. So I'm wondering if you might have any ideas of what that noise might be. This is AC2LA.
Well, certainly you had a good thought with putting an RF choke, because you can never have too many RF chokes, and that blocks some of the noise. You would think that it would be more important for when you were transmitting, but unfortunately all these rigs do generate, they have local oscillators, and their shielding can be a little bit less than optimum, and so you could feed the local oscillator circuit into your further down the chain. Now, I'm not quite sure exactly what's getting plugged from the TS2000 into the other box. Is it a strict audio signal, or is it a, because I doubt that it's a USB signal, because I don't think the 2S2000 has USB capability. It probably has a CIV a command that runs on an RS-232 interface. So I'm assuming that you're taking the audio out of the TS-2000 and plugging it into the audio input of a sound card of that little box that you have added to the chain.
Yep, that's exactly correct. It's the audio output from the Kenwood TS-2000, and it goes into a very tiny box that is an external sound card, and it's used for like Gritty and PSK and stuff like that. And then from there, there's a USB connection to the computer. So there's three devices or three, you know, what are the three devices, I guess you would call it, the computer, external sound cord, and the TS-2000, and they're all connected. And it goes computer to the sound card, the external sound card to the TS-2000.
Okay, I always like to go kind of logical with these things. So my next question would be, have you tried to tap into the audio output of your TS-1000 with a different device to see if the output audio is clean?
I'm pretty sure the output, but when I card connected to the 1000, and I unplug the USB on the back of the computer, the sound goes away completely. So the culprit is somewhere on the PC, but I also used a different PC. I used a laptop with it, and it did virtually the same thing, a little bit, like I said, 5, 4.5 or something like that. So, I'm going to have to call Signal like tomorrow or the next day or something to see what they think. But it's very weird.
Okay, I hate to tell you this, Dan, but you seem to be over-deviating. I would suggest you cut back on the microphone amplification because you're over-deviating the repeater and you keep falling out of the repeater. So I'm getting about half of what you're saying. So I'm not quite sure exactly. You went into great detail, but I didn't get enough words to kind of connect them all into one fell swoop. Have you ever tried a line isolator, a transformer isolator, or, you know, one of those small one-to-one audio transformers in case there's something that's on the line that's getting through that usually can kind of help an audio signal in situations like this?
No, I didn't try the transformer. And I'm just wondering if the audio sounds better now. I didn't try a transformer, but I think I have one. I'm not sure if it's the right kind. It might not be a one-for-one. Is that the right kind to get? Because I could try that.
Well, preferably one-to-one would be the best suitable because probably the impedance levels are the same on your transceiver as the little breakout box. If it's only a 1-to-2, you can probably get away with it. You don't want something that's you know, 30-to-1 because then you're going to have a wide impedance mismatch and that introduces problems into the signal as well. So the closest to a 1-to-1 isolation transformer, the better. It can always be beefier. You know, you don't have to worry about power handling capacity for a audio signal that just feeds a headset or a computer input.
All right, sounds good. And I'll give a transformer a shot and see if that works. And I'm going to call SignalLink in the next couple of days. And I'll let you know how it goes. But just before I go, did my audio sound a little bit better? I turned down the mic gain. This is AC2LA.
Well, there's a little noise around the edges, but you're not falling out of the repeater. So as far as the mic gain levels, it's fine. Before, you were over-deviating, and when the repeater sees the frequency going too far one direction or the other, it just shuts itself off. But now you transmit it 100% of the time. I was able to follow every single word you said.
All right. Thank you so much. And this is AC2LA. I'll be listening.
Okay, Doc. Next on the list is Wesley, N2XJN. You wanted to speak about lightning. On the same subject, one of the many topics that I scribbled on my little scratch pad once upon a time was a very interesting article that seems to demonstrate that the lightning bolts that we assume are just lightning bolts are actually particle accelerators, and nuclear reactions happen inside lightning. So maybe we can kill two birds with one stone tonight, Wesley.
Yeah, I have something even more exciting. Amplitude 241 and the radium were used in the 60s for creating lightning rods or lightning devices that were receiving most of the lightning strike due to ionization created by a ionizing emission of amplitude 241. Some information, amplitude 241 was obtained in 1944 by bombarding neutrons on the isotopes of plutonium in nuclear reactor at the University of Chicago. The thing is that, let me just... The thing is that we have a similar phenomena that are happening in the air where natural nuclear reactions are happening due to the lightning strikes. So I'm trying to put all together in one thing is first, those phenomena are considered to be a secondary ionization. Secondary ionization creates the path for the lightning. Then it comes to the lightning rod that is radioactive with some sort of the upward basket that is holding that ionized air inside. And then we could have a constant delivery of the voltage from the lightning strike. By that, we creating an ionizing path that is a continuous nuclear reaction in it. Before we go to the question, Kyoto University in Japan, they had four detectors recorded. They recorded discharges from two simultaneous lightning at a distance of 2 kilometers away, 1.5 miles, and they found gamma ray photons generated by initial lightning strike having knocked neutrons out of stable atoms. Now here's the interesting thing is that originally when they were creating in 1944 amplitude 241, they were actually using the neutron interaction. And now we have the reverse thing that we have the neutrons that are being knocked out due to lightning strike. At first, the question is, how come the temperatures that are not near the nuclear reaction, the fusion, could possibly knock out the neutrons? The second thing is, isn't that all phenomenon of the lightning strike going this way, not that way, is just in creation of the lightning path, which would be strongly ionized with the repeatedness through the same path of the energy of the lightning. I would like to hear some comment from you.
AC2GS. Well, but you kind of put a whole bunch of things simultaneously in the fruit basket, if you will. Apples, oranges, pears, grapefruits. And they're not all the same fruits, unfortunately. Number one, there's no fusion. There's no fusion that's taking place in lightning. If anything, it's fission. What happens is a very, very high energy electron that's traveling at a close to relativistic speed bangs into a nucleus and kicks off a neutron. So that's not fusion. That's to an extent, you could say it's fission. But it's simply a neutron being released, and then neutrons are very unstable. They have a half-life of about 15 minutes. They decay into protons, electrons, and neutrinos, and a little bit of energy off the side. So that's a different thing, and it's not fusion, and it's not a chain reaction. It's a one-shot type of a deal. Let me drop. So that's what's going on with the lightning. The primary source of the lightning is the electrostatic differences that build up in the clouds versus the ground, and a ionization trail is eventually generated, and multiple lightning strikes travel the identical trail because they've already been ionized, so it's the path of least resistance. So that's why lightnings kind of have that multiple discharge characteristic, and they can go from the cloud to the earth, they can go from the earth to the cloud. Both have been reported. So that's lightning bolts and secondary neutron emission with secondary decay products is what is seen as far as the Japanese and anyone else. It's not something that, unfortunately, you can hold on to and work as a generator of any kind. It's a kind of interesting phenomena, but it's not sustainable. Does that answer your question or part of the question?
I'm trying to find out how the path of the lightning strike is more significant towards another part due to ionization taking place there. Interesting.
Well, there's sort of a random statistical component. As you know, if you ever look at lightning bolts, they seem to run in straight lines for a small path, then they divert at an angle for another run at straight. And that's just the preferred ionization trail that's generated at the initiation of the lightning fire. There are ring lightnings that are very, very rare, but for the most part, you get these kind of fractal generations of ionization trails, and once established, it discharges the rest of the electrical potential between the cloud and the earth.
Okay. How about neutron that is freed, interacting with neighboring particles? Does that create any additional the ionization in presence of high voltage?
Well, I believe that the principal history of the free neutron, rather than it's not a high velocity free neutron that's going to act as nuclear reactors do. Fusion reactors slow down neutrons that are emitted so that they can be recaptured and cause chain reactions, and that's how fusion reactions, both in bombs and in energy generators, operate. But there's not enough concentration and not enough potential energy based upon the small number of neutrons. So effectively, the way that nature deals with the electron and the neutron is simply for it to decay into a proton, electron, and neutrino. That seems to be the overwhelming nature of the byproducts. It doesn't really lend itself to any kind of chain reaction that particularly improves the ionization generation. If anything, the ion trail occurs before the electrical discharge that generates the free neutron.
That's an interesting point. A positively charged ion contains more protons than electrons. So negatively charged ion contains more electrons than protons. The force between charged object is known for us as electric force. What I'm trying to say is when the atom on the part of the lightning strike lose the neutron, then we have an ion that is positive. That ion has a nature very much similar to an ion in near vicinity of the radioactive rod that was used in the 60s and 50s with the basket that was holding that ionized air inside. So do you see the similarity in creation of the ionized path for the next lightning to go through the same way by a similarity of the reaction and to exchange?
Well, in a word, no, because when the high energy electrons that knock the neutron out of the atom, losing a neutron does not impart any change in its electric charge, since neutrons are zero charged particles, net particles. And so you have an atom that was neutral, you knock the neutron out of it, you now just have a slightly lighter atom that is still neutral. So there's no charge to it. And the decay of the neutron, as I mentioned before, is a proton that's positively charged, an electron that's negatively charged, and a neutrino that's not charged. And so you have conservation not only of charge, momentum, but of something called lepton numbers, which is what electrons and neutrinos are, and that's why you need a neutrino. Actually, it's a electron antineutrino. It has a lepton number of -1. An electron has a lepton number of 1. So together they have a total of 0, and a neutron has a lepton number, for all intents and purposes, of 0. So it's conservation of all kinds of things, but it's also conservation of charge. There's no charge involved in the neutron expulsion.
I don't hear the people.
Yeah, we seem to have lost our courtesy tone. I assume Eric is working on that as well.
Yeah, it'll come back in a minute.
So anyway, Wesley, this is a totally charge-conserved phenomena. It produces interesting radioactive decay materials in its path, but other than that, it does not really change the charge of the atoms involved.
No, you got to look at it from different point. I agree with you. In a simplified classical view, the negative skin of the neutron assist is to be attracted by the protons with which it interacts in the nucleus. And yes, the main attraction between neutrons and protons is via nuclear force, which doesn't involve charge. However, the freed neutron interacts with another neighboring atom. And then we have a neutron bombardment of an atom and creation of all a lot of particles.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I don't know how much you got from it.
Well, I can't tell you exactly what percentage. It's probably something along the lines of 50%. The problem is that there's no good documentation that the free neutrons are interacting with any other atom. They might be, but they very well might not be. The only thing that the Japanese have sort of proven was the decay products of neutron decay, not necessarily any kind of further nuclear interaction. Not all free neutrons are just going to bang into a nucleus. Nucleuses are very small objects, and it's very easy to skirt them. And although they're not, the neutrons won't be repelled, you still have to have enough of a population of neutrons aimed in the general direction of an atom to have them strike a nucleus. So my guess would be the amount of neutron-nucleus interactions are abysmally low.
Well, when we're looking at neutrons, we have two kind of neutrons, slow neutron and fast neutron. The slow neutron is the one that interacts, that goes through the medium that is slowing it out. And then the probability of interaction is greater the slower neutron it is with neighboring particles. Fast neutrons, they sooner or later, they have to do something with themselves. They cannot exist by themselves. Do you agree with that?
What happens is during radioactive decay, neutrons are released that are very high velocity, high momentum.
The time is 8:47 p.m. The time is 8:47 p.m. Ready.
Okay, the repeater is having a little bit of a stroke or something. But anyway, As I was trying to say, the neutrons from a fusion reactor, a fast neutron, they're slowed down in a carbon pile so that they become thermal or slow neutrons so that they can be captured if the population of neutrons are high enough. The problem with the lightning is the neutron population is very low. So even though the velocity of the neutrons that are thrown out of the atoms are slow, there's very few of them, and so the amount of neutron interaction is minimal, and most of the atoms around are not that sensitive to chain reactions. In fusion reactions, you have plutonium and you have uranium that if you just wiggle a neutron anywhere near it, it goes through a chain reaction and fusion again. In atmosphere of hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and such, you know, if you throw a neutron at it, it just kind of says, yes, so what else? So, it's again, it's apples and it's oranges.
Yeah, I wasn't able to check how long is the half-life of nitrogen-14, but this is the one that is that was discovered by the Japanese scientists to be created in the lightning strike. So if you can check it out, what I'm saying is, do we have a long-lasting or short-lasting but repeated phenomena in the lightning path that would make increase the chances for the next lightning to go the same way?
Okay. Nitrogen-14 is a stable isotope. So it's not going to decay, unfortunately, and it's not going to manifest the type of ionization potential that you would like to see it do.
Okay, so now my assumption is that we have a zillions of lightning strikes. We have the waveguides between the ionosphere and the Earth, and we have, due to Schumann response, 8.94, I believe, frequency, one lightning strike causes a series of lightning strikes around the globe. And that is repeating many times. So now we have accumulation of nitrogen-14. Should I understand it this way?
Yes, nitrogen-14 is a naturally occurring isotope of nitrogen. Mostly they're 15, but you knock a neutron, and it's 14, but it's rock hard stable, and it's not going to decay or give you any problems down the road. But that's one of the ways that we have the amount of nitrogen-14 in our atmosphere from lightning bolts. But you also have to realize we have a lot of nitrogen atoms. Even though we have a bunch of lightning, not all lightning produces a great deal of nitrogen-14. And so, you know, in the nature of things, most of the nitrogen you're going to find is still going to be 15. Even though lightning is kind of, you know, you tune on to 160 meters, I love to get back to amateur radio, and 80 meters, and you can hear those lightning strikes all over the place. It's just not as diffusely common as it would need to be to, if you, for some odd reason, wanted to have a lot of nitrogen-14 in the air.
I have a problem with that. The afterglow. Afterglow, the initial afterglow that has died away by those researchers was detected as a second signal about a minute after that, 1 minute. And the signal was in a very much strong peak of energy, 0.51 mega electron volt. So we're talking about kilo electron volts for X-rays. We're talking 465 for cesium-137. And then we have a mega electron volt peak coming out from the afterglow. And those are mostly energy of gamma rays produced by electron-positron annihilation. And that is ionization. And to XGR.
Well, it's been a while since I read the article. I don't exactly remember every last detail, but there is an inherent delay if you're detecting the neutron decay, because the neutrons don't decay as soon as they're free. As I said before, free neutrons tend to have a half-life of about 15 minutes, and somewhere in that 15 minutes, you will have a statistical average of neutrons decay into protons and electrons and neutrinos and the occasional gamma radiation to kind of make up the extra momentum that's lost so everything is conserved. But again, you're talking about the scientific studies required incredibly sensitive detection devices because it didn't just kind of bathe the entire area with these radioactive products. You had to look at it's even less than a needle in a haystack. It's a needle in a haystack, in a needle, in a haystack, in a needle, in a haystack, if you will. It's like nested haystacks. So it's interesting to see, but it's not practical in terms of production level of doing anything with it.
And I have, again, a problem with that. I'm going to recall you that article. They also found that the signal was the result of inverse beta decay of radioactive nuclei that had been produced when the gamma ray photons had knocked neutrons out of the stable atoms. And then we have two other species. We have a nitrogen 13 and we have a carbon 13. This one is emitting positron in half-life of 10 minutes. Now, if we think about one lightning strike causing another light...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, one of the mechanisms going on, and, you know, I'm a German because they're very long words, is something called the Bremsstrahlung gamma ray, which are gamma rays produced by the collision of high-energy electrons into atoms. You know, because lightning bolts are basically electrons traveling very fast between a very high potential. They strike other electrons, they produce gamma rays. Those gamma rays can do all kinds of fun things. The gamma rays can cause neutrons to be thrown out of nucleuses. They can even create matter-antimatter particle pairs. So, you know, Bremsstrahlung gamma radiation can do all these things. But again, it's a phenomena that happens in very small numbers. It's not anything that you can scoop up and do much with. It makes for interesting findings, but if you try and hook it up to the other end of a power generator, you're not even going to be able to generate Richard's MFJ clock with the power.
Yes, I don't want to hold this discussion longer, but Bremsstrahlung is the electromagnetic radiation produced by deceleration of charged particle when deflected by another charged particle. Isn't that what is happening with knocked out neutrons that are going through the medium? They slow down and they have to interact with something, creating some kind of phenomena, and I believe that at first, it increases the radiation around the Earth, especially when the pilots are flying constantly, bombarding them. It's not only cosmic radiation, let me jump. But also, it is important from the standpoint of how we should build our lightning protection devices. We're not using any longer ionization one. Although I have in mind something that would be easy to be done, creating a ionization around the lightning rod with no means of radioactive isotopes being present, but by creation of capacitively charged high voltage devices that would constantly interact with and ionize with due to the weather change and to exhale.
Okay, maybe you should consider patenting that. I think it would probably be terrible as far as marketing to sell any kind of object that has any ionizing radiation on it. People are afraid of cellular phones. You can imagine if they come out with a full line of lightning arresters that glow in the dark. So I think purely as a marketing ploy, it would be counterproductive. Usually, as long as you make the things very pointy, you give it a discharge potential that's better than, you know, if you have a round ball that's conducting. So I don't know if there's that much of a big market in improving lightning arresters and such, but who knows? You may have come up with a good idea.
I agree with you on the, in the 80s, mostly the South American production of the radioactive lightning rods have been seized, and all of that stuff was removed. Although it was very soft, low maneuvering with that removal, but later on, actually, that production died out. Let me up. Yes, I have something in mind that would not use ionization radiation coming from the isotopes, but actually coming from the static electricity potential. But that's another story. Anyhow, I believe the dead nuclear phenomena, including the ionization of air to the first lightning strike during the particular path, ending with the rod that is striking into, all of it makes probability more greater for another lightning strike to go to the same path at the same time, protecting what we need to protect, and to exhale.
Oh, yes, as I said before, there's this old line that lightning doesn't strike twice in the same place, but obviously it does. And certainly, if you have a fast enough time-lapse photography, you can see that multiple lightning bolts run right through the same exact path repeatedly in less than a second, because the area has been ionized, and so it becomes the easiest, you know. Electrons are kind of lazy. They'll take the easiest route imaginable. And there's nothing more conductive in air than ionized air. And so once you ionize it with the first lead lightning bolt, the rest of them just go right down the same exact path. So, yes, one lightning bolt makes a path for others over a very short interval. Eventually, the electrons are discharged. It dissipates, the ionization goes back to normal, and everything's well with the world.
Okay, thank you very much. That was interesting discussion, and I'm leaving space for another questions for somebody else. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Wes. So next on my list is Russ, W2RUS. You have a question for us tonight? Well, perhaps Russ stepped away. What about Steve, WA2IUS? Do you have a question for us tonight?
Oh, thank you. I've just been reading the mail. Just wanted to check in, let you know I'm here. I'm still here. Thanks, WA2IUS.
Okay, very good. Does anyone else have any questions, comments, statements for the technical net tonight? Come on, come all, you know? This is an opportunity to ask really strange questions tonight.
There was a Ted at the end, an N2, I think D-U-E. I don't know if he was just checking in or if he had a question. Roy.
Yeah, that was Ted, N2-D-U-E. He said he was just checking in to support us, but didn't have a question. So one more time, I'll just call out again. If anyone has any question that they would like to submit to the technical net for tonight.
KC2WTA, Joe at Staten Island.
Hello, Joe, what do you know? You got a question for us tonight?
No, I just wanted to stop in and say hello and listen to the net. Very interesting talk about...